It doesn't matter who you talk to nowadays, everyone's got an opinion on General Nhlanhla Mkhwanazi. Unfortunately, opinions are like other parts of the world. We all kind of have one, not always well founded. And we're trying at BizNews to uncover the truth, to share with you what's really going on. And that's why I'm delighted to be talking today to Dr. Jean Redpath. She's an attorney. She has a doctorate in law. She works full-time in the field of law and order. And she's been following what's going on at the Crime Intelligence Division of the South African Police Services, where everything is focused right now. So we're hoping that we can get more clarity on what is happening and maybe make our judgments based on fact rather than lots of emotion.
Hermanus, this is a man from this windy little town called Yaku. Sorry, other way around. Yaku's from Hermanus. Yaku, we need to talk about your upgrade problem.
I don't have an upgrade problem.
Two Audis, an Opel, a Kia, and a Hyundai. Five cars, Yaku.
Denial.
I just love cars. And we rebuy cars that make it so much easier for you and convenient. You sell your car. You want to try it?
Okay, just once.
Turn off the cameras.
I see how this is addictive.
Take two of those. We buy cars. The easiest way to sell your car by far.
Jean, thank you so much for joining us. You've been at the Institute, the Dalla Omar Institute. Before we go any further, there'll be a lot of young people watching and listening to this discussion, and they'll say, who's Dalla Omar?
He was the first Minister of Justice in South Africa, and prior to that, when the Dalla Omar Institute was called the Community Law Center, he and other academics and people at the Community Law Center were very instrumental in producing the first drafts of the Constitution. And so that's kind of the genesis of the Dalla Omar Institute.
And how did you, you've been there for over a dozen years, how did you end up going there?
Well, I was working as an independent consultant in the sector for about 10 years. And what ended up happening is I ended up having multiple contracts with the university, with the Dalla Omar Institute. And eventually they said, we're tired of writing all these contracts. Why don't you just become employed? I said, well, on condition that I don't have to drive to UWC every day and I can still maintain my other research interests. And they agreed.
And clearly you're living your best life. You've been there for over a dozen years. Things are going well. And boy, what an interesting field that you've chosen, given South Africa's situation right now. I'd like to, obvious question, crime intelligence. We will be digging deeper into it, but how has it been functioning over the last, let's say, 13 years that you've been at the Dalla Omar Institute investigating it?
Well, I think we heard in the Zondo Commission exactly how it's been functioning, which is, a great deal of abuse of resources, basically the capture under Richard Ndluli. Approximately 300 members of his family were appointed in the division. In other words, a very bad situation during the time of state capture, which hasn't entirely reversed yet. So although Ndluli himself and many of the people he appointed are no longer there, what we still have is a culture and a tradition in the institute in crime intelligence, which is extremely problematic. And part of what we're seeing now is a pushback against attempts to reform that situation.
Jean, let's just go into a little more detail of what's actually been happening at crime intelligence and why it has become such a problematic area. You did say. Use those words. Can you elaborate on it?
Yes. So the problem is the funds to which they have access. There is a police vote 28, which has a line item for crime intelligence. But that's not only where crime intelligence gets its funding from. There is also in the State Security Agency budget, which forms a direct charge against the Treasury and under vote 8. And there is a portion of that budget, which is not in the public domain, which goes through to crime intelligence. And it is that budget in particular, not only, but in particular, that has been abused, and money has been spent on all sorts of things. The allegations abound about use to buy votes in elective conferences. I have no direct knowledge of that, but those are the kinds of allegations that are being discussed. Not only that, but just to personally, for people to take the money for personal gain, that has also occurred, not just for political influence. And then we also had the Mdluli family with approximately 300 members being appointed, getting jobs within crime intelligence who weren't really set up to be able to do those jobs. And so really a division that was not doing the job that it was supposed to do and was using up the funds for illegal and personal gain.
And now that we have this bursting into the open of all kinds of allegations and quite clearly two sides. On the one side, for those who haven't been following the story, General Nkwanazi is being put together with the Commissioner of Police, Masemola, and the head of crime intelligence, Khumalo. And then on the other side, you have the minister who's been suspended, Minister Mchunu Sibiya, who's the deputy head of police, Paul O'Sullivan. Politicians are being brought into it. Fadil Adams, I spoke to yesterday, he handed over some documentation that was slipped under his door, he says, and so now he's prime evil, according to Nkwanazi. Even Patricia Mashile, who featured very prominently on Biz News, who had to go into hiding because they were after her, to kill her because of what she had disclosed. This is, and the public, however, seems to be very much camped on the one side. Is this because that side's right, in other words, Nkwanazi, or perhaps because they aren't well informed?
So I think that Nkwanazi, people are desperate for a hero, and Nkwanazi has taken a public stance which appears to be tough on crime in KwaZulu-Natal. And he has a very large following on social media, which he encourages. And so it's reminiscent of the kind of social media support that Jacob Zuma had around the whole white monopoly capital situation, where that was used as a tool to support Zuma. Now, Nkwanazi, the July the 6th allegations followed closely on a number of things, one of which was the imminent arrest of Dumisani Khumalo for the appointment of someone who was not qualified in crime intelligence by the Investigating Directorate Against Corruption, which is part of the NPA. It's not part of the SAPS. It also followed on the leak into the press, I believe it was News 24, Karen Morm, of the recommendations by the Inspector General of Intelligence that both the National Commissioner, Masemola, and Khumalo be disciplined and perhaps prosecuted for expenditure on a number of buildings in KwaZulu-Natal at incredibly inflated prices, where commission was paid not in the normal way, but to somebody else. And it seemed that there was abuse of public funds there. So the timing of Nkwanazi's allegations seems to be a reaction to attempts to close the taps on some of the abuses within crime intelligence. The timing seems to suggest that.
And I guess it all goes back to state capture. And as you said earlier, this fellow Mdluli, who was appointed there and had access to, is it a slush fund? If you don't have to account for it, yeah.
Yes, that's the fund which the secret fund which falls under the Treasury budget, which is not in the public domain, and which relies on the Intelligence Committee of Parliament and the Inspector General of Intelligence to, be the oversight over that, and This is probably the first time that an Inspector General of Intelligence has tried to do anything relating to that fund. And now he himself has been suspended by the president.
Sure. What do you make of all of this, Jean? Help us as just, you know, the members of the public who are terribly confused. We get caught up in the drama, the excitement. We want a hero, as you say, Mkhwanazi. What should we be looking for to understand what's really going on?
I think we need to understand policing in KwaZulu-Natal in a historical context. So, you know, at the time of the transition in 1994, the country almost didn't make it because KwaZulu-Natal refused to sign up. And we, you know, they had to vote separately, et cetera, et cetera. And then with the finalization of the constitution, the constitutional principles around sort of a more federal structure were also not complied with, particularly around policing. And the Constitutional Court almost did not affirm the final version of the constitution. And this was all around the fact that in KwaZulu-Natal, the police were going to absorb the KwaZulu police, who were loyal to the former Inkatha leadership and would not be loyal to any new government. And the likelihood was that the province of KwaZulu-Natal would fall under the IFP after the election. And that is, in fact, what happened, and not under the ANC. And so the fear was that there would be this police agency that was not under control of the national government and was loyal to a different political entity, which is why a much more centralized structure around policing was created. And so now we have the situation where provinces have almost no powers over policing. The provincial commissioners answer not to provincial leadership, but up the chain within SAPS. And what we see now in KwaZulu-Natal is that whole dynamic became calmed when the ANC took over control of politically over KwaZulu-Natal. Now we are in a situation again where the ANC is under threat in KwaZulu-Natal. And policing is a key part of that picture again. And so we have to see it in context. Senzo Mchunu was premier for a short time and was forced to... So he is the minister who's now embroiled in all of this. He was premier of KwaZulu-Natal. He was premier for a short time, and he was forced by the ANC to stand down in favor of Willis Mchunu, who's no relation, but be that as it may, to settle the political dynamics within the ANC. Willis Mchunu is now with the NK. So you can see that there's a very very political overtones to this whole situation. Now, Mkhwanazi took great exception when I mentioned this in a television interview that they were political factions. It may be that Mkhwanazi is not part of that, but is loyal to people who are part of those factions. But what he is clearly allergic to is any kind of control or any kind of control of his fiefdom, which includes this task team, which over 6 years had close to $500 million in funding in a very constrained environment where the police tell us day after day that they have no money, they have no vehicles to respond to crime in progress, et cetera, et cetera. In a context where violence in KwaZulu-Natal has, during the time of the life of the political killings task team, the murder rate increased by 58% in KwaZulu-Natal, whereas the rest of the country also an increase, only 24%. So things are much worse from a crime perspective during the life of this entity. And often we find that entities create good, well-intentioned entities can have a good impact. A good example is the Gauteng aggravated robbery strategy, which the current acting minister, when he was MEC in Gauteng, although he had no power, he created this strategy which saw cooperation between various people and which targeted convictions of the people involved in aggravated robbery, hijackings, et cetera, et cetera. This had a massive impact on crime in both Gauteng and KwaZulu-Natal because they went for the kingpins, they went for the center of the problem rather than the accomplices. This doesn't seem to be what has happened with the political killings task team. A handful of convictions, vast expenditure rolled over year after year, 74 million. And this was expenditure over and above people's salaries. And for the life of me, I don't know under what policy we are paying for the laundry of this task team. But, you know, every 6 months, it's half a million on laundry. So, you know, and what Minister Mkhwanazi was doing was saying, we're going to stop this and we're going to redirect the resources. And this reaction to that does seem to be disproportionate.
Oh, okay, so now we kind of get it. It's not just factional fighting, it's resources that we're fighting over. And that's the core, the root cause of so many problems in society at large. And when you talk about big numbers here and unaccountable, you get the money, you don't have to account for it. Well, of course, you don't want to let it go if you are the person who's enjoying that privilege.
Yes, and the documentation explicitly says that the funds are to be managed by Provincial Office KwaZulu-Natal. So that's basically it's Mkhwanazi's money. It's his people that he gets to direct to go all over the province and it seems outside the province, paying for accommodation, meals, daily stipends. And yet they were seemingly unaware and did not give any advance warning of the July 2021 riots. They're investigating political killings. They're immersed in the political realm, but nothing around the riots in 2021. And their mandate doesn't seem to investigate the 300 to 500 people who died during those riots. So, it's... The picture is complex. It's not straightforward, but it does seem to be a reaction against the possible withdrawal, not only of resources but of a force that is beholden to the provincial commissioner rather than to anyone else. Obviously, if you're one of those members and your salary is effectively being doubled. By the existence of this task team and that money is coming to you through the provincial commissioner, you're going to have a particular loyalty to that person. And so that is also part of the picture.
Yesterday, I spoke with Fadil Adams, and I mentioned him a bit earlier, the Member of Parliament for the National Coloured Congress, who was recently elected in 2024, and he got the documents, and he's now been attacked by Mkhwanazi. And he said, what bugs him most of all is that there is so much murder and mayhem on the Cape Flats, which is his community, and they are massively under-resourced, whereas these fellows seem to be living it up in the Oyster Box Hotel, drinking their Johnny Walker Blue Label and cream soda, and just having the life of Riley. And that's part of what he's unhappy about. There would surely be others in society. You think about the farm murders. That constituency is saying, hang on a minute, where's the farm murder killing team? Why is there a political killing task team? What was the argument for that in the first place, given these other priorities that the country has?
Well, it was a recommendation arising out of a commission. So it wasn't intended to be permanent. It was intended, the initial authorization was for 6 months. 6 months to hit the phenomenon on the head, find the hitmen, because it was obviously hitmen rather than, the people themselves carrying out the murders, and shut it down. But then it just was reauthorized and reauthorized and reauthorized year after year after year. A task team is not a permanent structure. A specialized unit is. And I think that is also where the public might be helped in understanding that. It was never intended to be a permanent structure. It's not part of the structure of the SAPs. It's not counted for in the budgets, in the organogram, in the annual reports, none of that. So it's a discretionary amount that needs to be strongly evaluated every 6 months about whether it should continue or not in the light of other priorities.
And it hasn't been because of state capture?
Well, because of vested interests. Kumalo, Mkhwanazi, Masemola are just rolling it over. Yeah, they are the ones involved who just roll it over year after year. I've personally been involved in a court case against the police around the issue of the under-resourcing on the Cape Flats. We won that court case. The police were ordered to change their formula so that areas on the Cape Flats and other areas, which include some areas of KwaZulu-Natal, which were in the former homeland areas, which also have very high murder rates. And they have not done so. There was a commission of inquiry, the Khayelitsha Commission. There was a recommendation there. They did not comply. 3 years later, the Social Justice Coalition took them to court. We won the case. It took some years. Still, they have not complied. Now the judge is calling them in every year or so to check in. The applicant, the Social Justice Commission, has all but collapsed. I was the expert in the case. I was not the applicant. I'm basically all that's left. And still, they refuse to make the necessary adjustments. It's an organization that is moribund, that does not want to change. And any attempts to change the way things are strongly resisted. And so, we say that the minister shouldn't interfere, but then we hold the minister to account. So, somewhere along the line, the minister has to be able to say, these are the priorities of our government, and this is where the money is going to go. I would argue, within the realm of appropriate direction given by the minister. The Constitution says the commissioner controls and manages police force subject to the directions of the minister. Now, obviously, the minister can't say, investigate this person, investigate that person, fire at this person. Obviously, he can't do that. But the priorities, the strategies, the policies, the spending of money, that is definitely within the realm of what a minister should be allowed to do, especially in the current situation where our ministers are probably slightly less corrupt than the people that were appointed under the previous situation. So it's almost a reverse of what we had before. We had these corrupting ministers who captured these institutions by appointing all these people. Now we have somewhat less corrupt ministers who may be trying to do a better job, but the resistance is in the institutions. And so we have to be very careful about where exactly the line on political interference, our imagination of what is political interference, is drawn. It's not clear-cut. We have to have a situation where if a minister sees illegal behavior, there's quite a lot of evidence that the task team used a disproportionate force in many situations. So that also comes into the mix. A minister has to be able to say, this is not okay, or we're not going to spend this money anymore. Otherwise, how can he be held to account for the police? So it's these kind of questions that this whole commission and the ad hoc committee are airing. Unfortunately, the quality of the cross-examination, the witnesses that have come forward, it's turned into a he said, she said, rather than really getting down to these broader problems, and I was really upset when the National Commissioner said the police are not in crisis, because on absolutely every data point that I've been tracking over 20 years shows that they are in crisis. And you know, that kind of denial means that he's not prepared to make the necessary changes, which we absolutely need for our police to get into a better place.
Jean, just ahead of the 2024 election, there were many analysts who were saying this was a battle between the constitutionalists and those who didn't want a constitution. In other words, this constitutional democracy that we have in South Africa, and those, on the other hand, who didn't want the constitutional democracy. From listening to you and having, I guess, my eyes opened in certain respects, I'm getting a sense that this battle wasn't ended in 2024 and that it continues. And indeed, this is an example of it, or is that an exaggeration?
No, I think you're absolutely correct. What we are seeing now is the beginnings of the battle for the succession to Ramaphosa. Whatever his failings, his deputy Mashatile is going to come in unless there is a credible opponent, you know, in the ANC. So I know it's still two years hence, but you know, it's starting now. And part of the picture is Senzo Mchunu moved up the ladder of popularity remarkably quickly at the last conference, and he was sort of seen as a potential threat to that shoe-in of Mashatile. And that is also what is playing now out in the dynamic. Is Mchunu's role has always been slightly on the Ramaphosa side of things, and is a possible combatant or opponent to the more Mashatile faction, which Ramaphosa has to placate all the time in order to maintain his position.
And finally, that July the 6th bombshell press conference of General Mkhwanazi, where he appeared there in battle fatigues. We've just had this week the overthrow of the government in Madagascar. There have been other coups around the world where Gen Zs, young people, are saying, we're not going to take this nonsense anymore. And then they've been perhaps manipulated, perhaps supported by men with guns. Was that what we saw on July the 6th? Because Fadil Adams suggested it could be something very dangerous.
Well, I think it's an implied threat to anyone who comes up against the position that he's taken or the narrative that he's putting forward. If you look at the people in his first few days of testimony, all the people that he criticized were people who had somehow wanted to turn off the taps or expose the spending or corruption. The attacks on journalists saying, you know, it's threatening state security. Well, finding out that, you know, the National Commissioner overspent by, you know, hundreds of millions a building in Durban, is that a threat to national security? It's something that's the job of journalists to expose, right? It's so attacking journalists. He even mentioned me after a television interview. And when you have someone like that, and Mary de Haas, who's a well-respected violence monitor in KwaZulu-Natal for many years, she's been particularly good at exposing abuses by the police. And by the way, the KwaZulu-Natal police are off the charts in terms of deaths as a result of police action. They account for more than a third of the country's total, even though they're not nearly a third of the number of police in the province. And so, yeah, so it is an implied threat. And I know that he had some justification for why he did it, but it's an implied threat. I had a number of people contacting me, judges, other people saying, you're very brave. Why should it be brave for me to express an opinion about the legalities, about what might be going on? It's a very dangerous situation where people are afraid to speak out because, yeah, and that is what that was his intention. I strongly believe it was his intention by wearing camouflage uniform, having all those people with guns under his command. It's a very, very dangerous situation. And the popularity that he has is also very dangerous, given the record that we see. He's actually trust in the police in KwaZulu-Natal is lower than the rest of the country. It's at 18%. You know, the high in South Africa was 46% in around 2011. It's dropped down to 22% for good reason. But in KwaZulu-Natal, it's even worse. And he's been in charge for the last 6, 7, 8 years. So that tells you something that is not perhaps on social media, what ordinary people are experiencing about how the police are operating.
Data does reflect or give you a picture of reality rather than the world of narratives. But how do you see this all ending up? How's this all going to play out?
Well, I don't have a crystal ball, but I do. So what I do still have faith in is some of the stalwart institutions of our democracy, which includes the judiciary, which includes the press. And it also includes elements in the prosecuting authority. So I've been very critical of them, but there are still good people trying to do the right thing. When it comes to the police, it's going to be a huge battle to turn that vast ship of close to 200,000 people around. And I think we may need new laws for that. The SAPS Act is not up for the job. We need a whole reimagining of how we do policing in this country. So I think that as far as the commission goes, as we hear more evidence from more different voices, perspectives will begin to change. And there may well be some prosecutions that come out of it. There may not. The fear is that it will be the wrong people who end up being prosecuted or disciplined, which is so far seems to be the case with the suspension of the Inspector General of Intelligence. You know, the president is not obliged to suspend the Inspector General on receipt of a complaint, but he may. So we don't know what the complaint was. The speculation is that it's around this release of information. And until we know that the actual complaint probably is speculation, but it's a may, it's not a must. And the speed of his action when compared to, say, the removal of the Director of Public Prosecutions in Gauteng, Andrew Chauke, where Advocate Bettoy asked for his removal, and it took more than 2 years for the president to act, even as prosecutions and justice in Gauteng were just getting worse and worse and worse. And it took Ramaphosa 2 years to act in that instance. So it's an interesting situation, and it seems like Ramaphosa's position has been weakened and that he has to take these kind of placatory actions in order to survive.
Dr. Jean Redpath is a senior researcher at the Dada Omar Institute at the University of Western Cape and a highly respected analyst and commentator, as you heard, based on data of criminal justice in South Africa, opened certainly my eyes on many issues. Hopefully your eyes as well, if you've been part of what Paul O'Sullivan and Fadil Adams call the Mkhwanazi cult. This is our future that's at risk. It is to do with the battle, as she confirmed, which we all spoke about ahead of the 2024 election, between those who want a constitutional democracy in South Africa and those who want something, well, far more controlled by the big man. This is a subject that we will be continuing to focus our attention on because it really is critical for the future of our beautiful country. I'm Alec Hogg from BizNews.com.